Hello, this is it's so good to be here. And it's been a wonderful stay for me, which I'm so grateful to Aya Gunasari and all of the nuns and Anagrikas and everybody who's made my stay so wonderful. So tonight, I believe the talk is called, basically, it's about how I started working in an Indian slum, how I became a nun of the slum. And I was just, as I was meditating tonight, this image came to me of how we are all just like metal under the hammer of karma. Like an old-fashioned pot maker or someone beats metal into a shape. And I was thinking at any time something terrible can happen to us. We can die, we can get sick, we can be parted from the ones we love. And our life can be smashed, destroyed. And in that sense, we are kind of helpless in the face of birth, old age, sickness, and death, helpless in the face of karma. But there is another way to live. Which understands that karma means action, that it's not destiny, and that you can become the architect of your own future. They say, heir to my actions, the receiver of my actions, So, in a way, that's what the Buddha gave us. He gave us a key to become the architects of our own future. And to a way to untangle the tangle, a way to answer life's big questions, a way to go beyond birth and death to the far shore, to the deathless, to the uncontaminated, the unbound, to the boundless. So that's the good news of Dhamma, that it's not just suffering and we have no choice. The thing is, there is suffering, but there is an end of suffering and there is a path. So. And the thing is to realize who is the one beating this metal so relentlessly? Who started, this whole cycle, this tangle? We, our own ignorance. Is us who creates this, So we have to look at how we live with mindfulness, with awareness, look at how we live with our body, speech, and mind. And create something good with our life. Because many people take up the Dharma because we think that it's about us, it's about my peace. I want to feel good. I don't want to suffer anymore. I'm confused. I'm bored. I'm lonely. I've lost everything. And that's okay, they're all good reasons for coming to Dharma. But the reason you should stay and your spiritual practice, it would be good if you could grow beyond just that, And in my experience, the more people have a deep spiritual practice, the more they understand that we are all intimately connected. This arises because that arises. This comes because that comes. This is in relation to that. There is only short in relation to tall. There is only poor in relation to rich. There is only black in relation to white. There is only justice in relation to injustice. There is only youth in relation to old age. And if we see that we are all intimately connected, this sense of compassion arises, that Mahayanas develop into a sublime compassion that we call bodhicitta, which is the wish to free all beings from suffering. And it sounds like a really hard job to liberate all beings from suffering when we can't even liberate ourselves from suffering. But if you understand that you are connected to everything and that we are all woven into this rug of interdependence together, then it kind of makes sense actually to work for the liberation of yourself and others, because we're already connected. That is our nature. Who grew your food? Who made your clothes? Who taught you to sign your name? Who gave you the eyes to see a beautiful sunrise? Or the human body to pursue your dreams? Or the chance to fall in love? Or the chance to follow the spiritual path? Even your mother, without your mother providing you and your father providing you this body, you couldn't do it. Everything we have comes from others. Without others, we don't exist. And in Mahayana, we say that all those annoying people who press our buttons, it is because of them that we will attain liberation. They will become the cause of our liberation. And in that sense, all the messy, smelly, difficult parts of life become a way that we practice, a way that we awaken, not a problem to be removed, but compost, grist for the mill, the petrol of awakening, you know. Because if there is no one to practice the paramis towards, the perfections of generosity, moral conduct, patience, joyous effort, concentration, and wisdom. There are six in Tibetan Buddhism, there's 10 in Theravada. If there is no one to practice those things towards, then we don't attain liberation. And some of you are probably saying, well, you know, this is a Theravada monastery, do we really need to worry about that? But even arhats need paramis. Even that's something we sometimes neglect in the West. We think, I don't need to give, I just need to meditate. And then you hear people saying, why isn't my meditation bearing fruit? I've been meditating for years and I'm still crazy and neurotic after all these years. Why has nothing changed? You know? And actually we have a lot to learn from the Asian people, you know, who have held Dharma for thousands of years, because they understand that being a Buddhist is not just about you. It's a community thing. Happiness is not a personal matter, not just a personal matter. Of course, you have to purify your own mind, but it's a communal matter because we're interconnected. We are social creatures. If one person in a family is unhappy, it affects everyone in the family. If one person is abusive or addicted, it affects everyone in the community. You know? So we work on our own mind to benefit others, and we benefit others because it gives us the good merit we need to travel far on the spiritual path. You know, you travel, you walk the road of spiritual practice with the legs of merit and wisdom, or compassion and wisdom. But you need this merit. This merit is a big part of spiritual practice. It's not just you know, something ethnic Buddhists do. It's actually the teaching of the Buddha. You know, the Buddha said, if beings knew the value of generosity as I do, they would not let one meal pass without having given. You know, that's why people in Thailand and Burma and Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam, before they have even eaten a meal themselves, fry up something and wait by the roadside for a monk to come. You know, it's not just for the monk, it's for their own well-being, because being loving, being generous, being ethical benefits you. In fact, it benefits you probably more than the person who is receiving it. It's just a better way to live. You know, and sometimes in the West we have so much, but we're never happy. We're always thinking, our mind is totally out of control. It never shuts up. We don't know how to be present and appreciate life as it's unfolding in the present moment. We have lost the fundamental ability to simply be. We have educated ourselves into so much complication that we have lost the point to be loving, to be fully aware, to touch the miracle of life in each moment. You know? So I never intended to live in an Indian slum. It just kind of happened. I Grew up in a kind of middle class family, church on Sunday, you know, that kind of family. I didn't really, I grew up in a country town where there's more sheep than people. And I didn't really meet a lot of minorities or people from other races. It was kind of a very small and sheltered life. But it all fell apart when my father died. And then I became a hippie in search of the meaning of life. And then at the age of 17, I traveled to India and Nepal and found Buddhism. And I just loved India, you know. It's such a chaos, such a chaotic place. But there is a sense of unbroken continuity, as if the past and the present and the future all meet in this kind of wonderful, unpredictable, sacred and profane world. And I felt so alive there because in India, you just never know what's going to happen. You know, you'll be sitting having a cup of tea and an elephant will come along the road, you know. Or you'll see people going to work on the bus, but because there's no seats and no standing room on the inside of the bus, they will cling to the outside of the bus. And they will show you what you would think is impossible is possible. They would show you that a family can live and thrive and be happy in a black plastic tent in a slum, that life could be possible. Not that it's a good thing, it's a terrible thing that people have to live like that, but it shows you how resilient human beings can really be. You know, because in my country, if someone serves our cappuccino not hot enough, you know, or if we don't like the bran in our muffin, we're like, oh my God, it's ruined my day. They didn't make it properly, you know? Or someone looks at us in a funny way or says something, they're like, how could they do that? How could they say that? You know, or the bus is late, or oh my God, you know, and in India it's like, yeah, there's no seats, okay, hold on to the outside. You know, there's no wire, okay, make a wire. You don't have electricity, hook it up, make your own. I mean, one could talk for hours about the history and the experience that is India. And one could say, you know, it's very spiritual and neglect the fact of the ugly reality of poverty or corruption. Or one could just talk about the poverty and not address the growing economy, the growing middle class, the growing wealth, you know. One could just focus on the ugliness and the poverty and the injustice and the gender inequality, and one could ignore the rich spiritual tradition, the rich tolerance, the amazing historical and architectural and holy sites, you know, the wealth of spirituality and all that India has given the world. Because when we think of India, we probably think Mother Teresa's slum. You know, she's kind of made India famous for that. But that's not all India is. India is the world. India is everything. One in five people in the world are Indian. But I can only speak of my experience. As a social worker in India and as a white woman. So in 1956, Dr. Ambedkar, who was like the Martin Luther King Jr. of his people, led 100,000 Dalits or more, Dalits being people from the so-called untouchable caste, who were made to work with, to skin dead animals, to collect garbage, to clean toilets, to work in the field for hardly any money for thousands of years. It was basically slavery. A few hundred years ago, if Dalits went into the temple, the Hindu temple, they would be beaten to death. The women were regularly gang raped by the landlords. They very seldom owned their own land. They had to tie a palm frond to the back to wipe away their footprints because even their footprints coming into the village was considered unclean to contaminate the village, especially if they walked past the high caste people's houses. They had to have a jar to collect their spit. In many cases, the women went topless. They just had a small sari, like up around their knees and maybe covering their chest. They were illiterate, they were beaten, they were exploited. And then, if they rose up or did anything against the high caste people, they would be lynched, they would be tortured. It was very, very much like slavery. But not only was it like slavery, it was religiously sanctioned racism against your own people. Because, I mean, of course, white people tried to find reasons to justify slavery or genocide against tribal people. But in Hinduism, it says in the Manu Smriti, it sanctions discrimination against women and discrimination against Dalits. It says Dalits' nature is inferior and they should be, cared for like children and take and do what is told by the high caste people, and then eventually they'll get a better birth. And it's because of bad karma that they've been born this way, and that, they're not spiritually evolved enough to take control of their own destiny. And that Dalits came from the feet of God, with the feet are considered dirty in Asia. And that, Brahmins came from the mouth of God, so they're the priestly caste. And then warriors came from the arm, the chest of God, the powerful place. And the merchants and farmers came, the farmers came from the stomach, I think. I could be, yeah, and the merchants somewhere in that area, basically. So it's religiously sanctified discrimination. The idea that not only is someone, I mean, in a country where there is inequality and poverty, for example, in a Muslim country, there are poor people, there are servants, but when you go to the mosque, everybody is equal in the eyes of God. And you may have a farmer and serf, but in the church, in front of God, everybody is equal in the Christian church, right? Basically. But in the Hindu temple, they couldn't even go into the temple because it was believed that they are too dirty, too inferior. So Dr. Ambedkar was the 14th child born in a mud brick house. His father was in the Dalit regiment of the British Army, and he went to school on a scholarship and he showed tremendous promise, but he had to sit outside the door and he had to wait for someone to give him water or food because he was not considered, good enough to have the high caste cook hand him food. There was all this discrimination he faced from an early age. Imagine having to sit outside the door, not being able to sit next to the other children, not being able to play with the other children. So then finally, a local Raja who was a very progressive man and wanted to improve the situation of people from the lower caste gave a scholarship for Dr. Ambedkar to finish high school, to go to college, and then to go to Columbia University in the US and also to England for a law degree and an economics degree. So through his own effort and through the generosity of that Raja, Dr. Ambedkar became one of the most highly educated Dalits and one of the most highly educated Indians of his time. And he started to understand that his people needed a revolution. How could he just take a comfortable government job and do nothing to help his own community who were living in such terrible backwardness, facing terrible poverty and lynchings and violence? He got a government job when he came back to India, but people would not directly hand him a file. They would push it along the desk or drop it at his feet. They would not serve him tea. They would not serve him water. Due to his surname, because you can always tell by a person's surname what their caste is, he was not allowed even to find a place in a hostel. He had to lie about his surname and pretend to be a Parsi to get a place to live. So Dalits, even though he was so well educated, he had a government job, he had money to pay the rent, he couldn't find a place to live. And, you know, so over time, he got kind of more and more frustrated with the way things were. And eventually, Nehru invited him to a draft. He joined politics and he started advocating for the rights of Dalits. And Nehru invited him to write the Constitution of India, which outlaws discrimination and casteism. But unfortunately, in India, laws are not always followed, and the reality of discrimination is still present in the lives of many Dalits today. Although it's not nothing like it used to be, many Dalits, because of the fight of Dr. Ambedkar, because he fought to get reservations in government jobs and schools and high schools and universities for Dalits, and that was a huge, that affirmative action. I mean, if you think about it, they lived off the slavery of these people for hundreds of years. So affirmative action is not inequality. It is literally we, you know, people who have profited from the works of slaves or the works of low-caste people owe them millions, you know, for their labor, for their unpaid labor over generations, you know. So affirmative action is just redistributing resources that should have been given to those people for generations. So these people are becoming middle class and are getting educated and know their rights. So their situation has improved, but it's still very backward in many places. And, you know, rates of malnutrition, rates of domestic violence, rates of child infanticide, rates of child marriage, rates of illiteracy are still much higher in the Dalit and tribal and other backward caste communities than it is in the high caste communities. And if you read the papers, you know, you'll find lots of stories about injustices, gang rapes, lynchings, especially when they try to have an inter-caste marriage. You know, if a lower caste boy tries to marry a high caste girl, he might get lynched in a village. That's still a reality today. It's not common, but it happens. 70% of marriages are still arranged to someone in your own caste, you know. So that way, wealth and privilege and religion and the structure of society, the structure of discrimination is perpetuated. So Dr. Ambedkar was amazing in the sense that he didn't fight. He realized that it would be best to wage a non-violent revolution for the rights of Dalit people. So he was very clever. He organized several kind of non-violent protests. One was to go into a tank where holy water was, where Dalits were never allowed to go, Dalits and women. And he drank the water of that place. And he said, "See, God didn't strike me dead. You know, I'm just a human being." And he burned the Manusmriti, which is the Hindu code of law that discriminates against Dalits and women. I mean, there are really many beautiful texts in the Hindu tradition also, but the law of Manu is full of discrimination, you know. So he burned it, and having read it myself, I think it wasn't a bad thing. And you know, he did marches, he did protests, he got people to organize for better wages, you know. So he just spent his whole life fighting this discrimination. You know, and many people think that Gandhi was the hero of the Dalits fighting, you know, for their welfare. But in fact, Gandhi said he would fast until the death unless Ambedkar stopped protesting for a separate vote electorate for Dalits. You know, because Muslims had already got a separate voting quota, which meant they were more powerful, they had more say in politics. And Dalits wanted that too, but Gandhi blocked it. So many Dalits feel that Gandhi was patronizing them. You know, he was playing the hero, wearing the poor's clothes, but not actually living the life of the poor. You know, because when he traveled, he would hire a whole train. You know, like one of his supporters said, it costs a lot of money to live in poverty for him, you know, because he was the son of a high-class landowner, you know. A high court minister, you know, so he had privilege. For those of us who are privileged, simplicity is a choice. But for those who are poor, poverty is not a choice. You know, and the thing about poverty is it's not romantic. It robs someone of their human dignity. It robs them, it makes them think and live in a very basic animal-like way where all you can think about. Survey, like science has shown that someone who grows up in poverty, their brain doesn't develop as well as someone who has all the facilities because that person is in a constant state of adrenaline-driven fear, thinking, how am I going to survive? How will I get food today? How will I not be raped today? How will I not be beaten today? And for half the world who lives on less than $2 a day, that is the reality of life. You know? In fact, half the world's wealth is in the hands of eight people, and most of them are American white males. Okay, just to give you an idea, half the world living on less than $2.50 a day. It's pretty shocking, isn't it? And according to the survey of some kind of Swiss economic organization, Russia is the country in the world that has the biggest gap between rich and poor. India is number two. So it's not that India is completely bankrupt. India has resources, but those resources are taken up in corruption and held in the hands of a few people. And that seems to be the trend all over the world, that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. There is a child born in India every 1.8 seconds, and 3,000 children will die every day in India due to poverty-related illness like diarrhea or malnutrition. And in the last 30 years, they estimate that 50 million girl babies in India and China have been aborted or neglected to death. Because they are girls. I mean, in India, if you're a Hindu, you have to pay dowry. You have to pay for someone to care for your daughter in marriage. You have to pay a bride price, you know, to the groom's family. And that can bankrupt you. So if you have five daughters, you're just in a really bad situation, you know. So people literally, another daughter could bankrupt them, you know. When a girl is born, they say better luck next time. When a boy is born, they give a sweet and they say congratulations. And one of the old blessings that old women give is may you be the mother of 100 sons. Yeah? So a daughter is a curse, a thief at the table, kanya dam, that which is given to another's family. And a son is the golden heir who will take care of you, your pension plan, your healthcare plan. In your old age, the one who will burn your body and ensure you go to heaven. Yeah. But Dr. Ambedkar, you know, tried to drive away a lot of this superstition, you know, and he said to the women, if your husband is beating you, you just lock him out. You know, he promoted, along with other OBC, other backward caste and Dalit people, he talked about educating women. He talked about ending child marriage. He talked about ending untouchability. He said, you are a man, stand up for your rights, reclaim your human dignity. And one of the ways he thought to do this was to go back, not adopt a religion of the foreign conquerors, you know, which would give white people more power, like Christianity, but to adopt the non-violent religion of Buddhism, more for human rights, more for social dignity, than as a religious path. But he said, you know, human beings need a moral path. They need something to give them inspiration and peace, you know. And he said, our struggle is not just a struggle for money or physical things. It is a struggle to reclaim the spirit of human dignity. You know, so he was a visionary, but he just had so many obstacles. Imagine trying to fight for the destiny of a million people. So it took a toll on his health. He was diabetic. He was under tremendous stress. There was, constant debates because not only did he have to unite his own people who were uneducated and illiterate and downtrodden, he had to fight against the people in his own country, the high caste people who held power, the other politicians, and then he had to kind of. There was really no one on his side, because even his own people didn't understand what he was trying to do. But they loved him, they really loved him. And for them, he's like a god. You'll always find in a Dalit, in an Ambedkarite house, because not all Dalits are Buddhist and not all Dalits are the followers of Dr. Ambedkar. It's mostly his own subcaste, the Mahar caste, that converted to Buddhism. But those people that converted in central India in 1956 are doing better than other Dalits because they transform their idea of themselves. They no longer say I'm untouchable. They say I'm Buddhist. They say I'm Ambedkarite. They know their rights. They're fighting for their rights. They are self-motivated. They don't pay dowry. They want to educate their daughters. And that's what I found when I went there about 10 years ago. I just found like it's like a when the flame and the tinder come together, the fire can ignite. They were just waiting for the flame to come. In fact, very few Buddhists know of this, the poorest and most oppressed Buddhists in the world. Very few Buddhists know of this community and their struggle for human dignity. And I was just in Bodh Gaya where the Buddha got enlightened. And I just saw the tremendous poverty and corruption there. Girls are married at 12. They have 8 kids. They live in a house that looks like a haystack. And they are dead by 45. They make more money begging in front of a Buddhist temple than they do working in the field. And I just thought these are the descendants of the Buddha. And then, there's the 5-star air-conditioned marble enclave where the foreign Buddhists live, or those who have enough money and luxury to think about more than just survival. And I was just looking at the extreme of this 5-star foreign Buddhist world and this real life of the Indian people and thinking, if the Buddha was here, which side of the fence would he be on? He was a man of the people walking the roads of India for the benefit of the many. And he said, we are not noble by our birth, we are noble by our actions. Yeah. He also said, when a king was unhappy that his wife had given him a daughter, the Buddha said, better a virtuous daughter than an unvirtuous son. The Buddha ordained 2,600 years ago, the Buddha ordained women who were thought of as men's property. The Buddha ordained Dalits who were thought of as less than animals in those times. He did that already. So already he was a kind of revolutionary, actually, a kind of humanist. That wasn't his main thing, but that was certainly something he did. So I think largely the work of Dr. Ambedkar, the legacy of Dr. Ambedkar is very impressive, what he managed to achieve, But there's still a lot of discrimination, there's still a lot of bad feelings, there's still a lot of people who don't understand why Dalits are angry and don't understand the pain and discrimination of what Dalits face. And I think there's so much in common between African Americans and Dalits, actually. Or any minority, any persecuted minority. So I went, I was just thinking in Bodh Gaya, I should help Indians, And then this man appeared before me and he said, where can I get Buddhist teachings? And then he said, oh, there's a whole bunch of Indian Buddhists in Nagpur. Why don't you come and see us? See what's going on. So I did. And then I saw what's going on and I stayed. There's lots of temples built by the government. They're in pretty bad repair. They don't have glass doors, they have wire doors that the cats can climb in and out of. So I got scabies. And I was just, people were so generous. They line up to give you food. They really want to feed you because they think it's good karma to give a monk food, and they'll press 10 rupees into your hands, But the is so spicy. I felt like a hungry ghost, I couldn't eat the food. It turned to fire in my mouth. And, the people would come and talk to me, And we would just kind of talk in body language because my Hindi wasn't very good. And the women, one woman, she bought me a baby that was dying, very thin baby, terrible crying, And it was very clear to me the baby was dehydrated and had diarrhea. And she said, please, you pray to Buddha for my baby, okay? You do chanting, okay? And I just thought, this baby needs medicine. For $2, I can save this baby's life. This baby needs oral rehydration and some antibiotics. $2. This baby does not need chanting. Where is the upaya in me chanting for a baby that has diarrhea, And I went to different people's houses, and because they have faith in monks, they'll invite you into their house and treat you like a god. In India, guru is God, husband is God, guest is God. So they'll invite you into their house, give you everything, want you to stay forever, ask you to do puja for them and give them good luck. But it's really hard to try and convince them to actually meditate for themselves. They just want good luck, But as these people opened up to me, women would just show me the bruises from their husband beating them or tell me about marital rape. And little girls would say to me, I'm 14 and I'm getting married next month. They've got pigtails, They've got ribbons in their hair, plaits, two plaits. They're skimping jump rope, and they're saying, yes, next month I'm going to get married. It's just crazy. How can you not do something when you see this? When you see this, your fellow human beings, my past life mothers, everybody's been your mother. How can you do nothing in the face of this? When you have the money, you have the resources, you come from a wealthy country where all you can complain about is that your cappuccino is not hot enough, or maybe you need a new car. Of course, there is suffering in the West, there is poverty in the West, but I never saw anyone lying dead on the street, When I was a homeless kid, there was always a charity there ready to help me. People cared and people were shocked and people felt bad, but in India, there is a beggar on every corner. I saw a man with maggots in his eyes. Like, I've seen terrible things. I've seen human beings being sold, Life is so cheap there. There's so much beauty, but so much pain there. I've seen two women giving birth in one bed, and after they give birth, they're forced to sleep on the floor because there is not enough beds, And a safe birth that we sponsored cost $3. But the only way we could get this woman out of hospital was to give a blood donation. And no one in my organization was above 50 kg. Or the husband was an alcoholic, so they didn't want his blood. So I had to give the blood in this really dirty government hospital where I'm like, oh, I get hepatitis from donating blood here. So I literally had to pay with my own blood to get this woman out of the government hospital where she was sleeping on the floor with rats and cockroaches with her newborn baby. People have asked me if I wanted to buy their babies. So just seeing this, it was hard for me to not get involved. It was hard for me to do nothing. So people say, why did you do that? Why do you live in India? Why did you start an organization? I thought Buddhist nuns were just supposed to meditate. And I'm like, yeah, that's true. But, well, for one, in my country, there is no monasteries where monastics of my tradition are supported without being charged to stay in the Dharma Center. So we have nowhere to stay, literally. So I went to India thinking, yeah, I can study there, it'll be easier. But then I went there and I realized, yeah, it's not easier. because I'm not Tibetan and I'm not a man. So it was just natural that I would gravitate towards other disenfranchised people. And it would be natural that, putting on robes and becoming a minority and becoming disenfranchised, that I started to sympathize with other disenfranchised people, because suddenly I understood what it was like on the other side of the fence of privilege when I was locked out of my own tradition by patriarchy. Before that, when I was a white, comfortable, middle-class woman, I didn't understand what minorities were complaining about. Only when I became a minority, to a small extent, because I can always go back to being a comfortable, white, middle-class woman, but to a small extent, when I got a little bit of a taste of that medicine, you can't do nothing when you're burning in injustice. You can't do nothing. You have to do something. You can't just say, this is my karma. Saying this is my karma for thousands of years got them slavery, So, we just started school sponsorships because it's shown that empowering the girl child is the best way. Education, empowering the girl child, because there's 33 million or more girls waiting to go to school who can't go to school. There's 30,000 girls, children, married every day in the world, most of them in India. 22% of Indian girls are married below the age of 18. 70% of Indian women are anemic. Girls receive less resources, less medicine, less education than boys. So the first way to address that is to empower girls with education. Don't just think what you can't do, start doing something what you can do, which is what I say to people, $40 a month, $30 a month, you sponsor a child, they go to school, they get a better future, they pay it forward, they help 10 girls, 20 girls. And in this way, by many drops is a pot filled, And people, I started giving talks and then people gave more money. And so then we started a food program that feeds 6,000 people a year, 6,000 meals per year for undernourished children, girls and boys. Then we started counseling for women suffering from domestic violence. Then I realized what these women need is job training. They need their own money. Break the cycle of poverty, give them a job. If they have a job, they can leave their bad husband, or they have more power in the family. The husband will think twice about hitting them when they're the main bread earner because they won't go to work tomorrow and he'll have less money for his alcohol, So we have a women's job training center where we teach them sewing, beauty therapies, English and computers. And then, there are all these girls in the villages who don't have a chance to go to university because the university is too far. Or girls who are too poor, so their parents are going to get them married off. So we started a girls' home for adolescent girls to go to high school and university and avoid child marriage, avoid being sold. Something like 70% of human trafficking is girls, And most of them from poor families, So these are the programs that we have, and this program runs on the income of two Americans per year. I don't know how much the average American makes, but it's about our charity runs on about 80, 70 or 80,000 American dollars per year. And we help 2,000 people per year. We sponsor 25 children to go to school. We sponsor 30 adolescent girls to go to university. We train hundreds of women in job training every year. And we also have Buddhist Sunday school for 100 children. We have Buddhist retreats. We do temporary ordination programs for girls and boys. We run retreats for lay people. We have a small Dharma center where we give teachings. We have a youth group. We have English classes. We help animals. I have six dogs. We've operated on lots of dogs. We've saved lots of puppies. And it doesn't cost very much, You just realize with a small amount, you can do so much. If you just start thinking, what can I do? Everybody can help somebody. And you realize sometimes by kind of helping others, you also help yourself. You recover from your own experience of disenfranchisement, you know, by becoming empowered. At least that was the situation for me. So that's what we do. What's the time? I've talked a lot. So I can just have a little photo session going, and you can see some of the photos. This is a painting I did. These are some of the children. Some of the children we sponsor in the youth group and the girls' hostel. One of the girls in our girls' hostel was crushing rocks on the side of the road and had never gone to school. So, you know, it's her first time going to school. So it's so exciting. Like, for us, school wasn't that fun. But for an Indian girl, it's so much better than crushing rocks or, you know, cooking, you know, or carrying water. It's a chance to expand their mind, and it gives them options in life, you know. Like Malala Yousafzai says, yeah, one pen, one teacher, one book, one child can change the world. And it's true. So this is the hostel where they're staying. These are one of our Sunday schools. You can see these things on the website, but it just to give you an idea. Some of the girls from our hostel. It only costs us $300 a month to feed, no, a bit more than that. More like $500 a month to feed the girls, and another $500 or so to pay their school fees. Astounding, actually. Yeah. One of the surprising things in India that you see every now and then. Yeah, these are our staff. We have 15 employees, and 75% of our staff are women. One of our events, sewing class. My translator and a social worker, he's 75% blind. Computer class, sewing. Maybe the Wi-Fi gone. So yeah, it's on our website, and there's a 12-minute doco as well. So does anyone have any questions? We're almost there.
I do have a
Yeah,
question.
sure.
I have three of them, or a little more. One is this: did Mahatma Gandhi and Dr. Ambedkar, they have any type of communication or?